Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Well, it's a busy start to week two of the Olympics for New Zealand, with Kiwis in action in eight sports today and medals in possibly three of those. The athletics program is in full swing, with Dame Valerie Adams winning yet another medal, while the swimming program ended with the US dominating. Elsewhere, a Belarusian athlete has refused to go home. There was a protest at the boxing, and athletes are breaking rules. Barry Guy with this report on the latest action from Tokyo and what lies ahead.
It's pretty even at the moment. Curley going well. Lamont Jacobs on the far side. And the Italian has done it. That is absolutely incredible. Lamont Marcelli Jacobs.
An upset, with Lamont Marcel Jacobs becoming the first Italian to win the men's 100 metres in a time of 9.8 seconds. Jacobs, who only switched from long jump in 2018, was born in the US to an American father, but moved to his Italian mother's homeland before he turned one. It was a night to remember for Italy, with Gianmarco Tamberi sharing the gold medal in the men's high jump when he and Mutsat Bashim of Qatar decided not to contest a jump-off. New Zealand's Hamish Kerr finished 10th. Earlier, it was another day to remember for Dame Valerie Adams, a fourth Olympic medal from five games. While this is likely to be her last Olympics, the Commonwealth Games are just a year away, and the 36-year-old won't be rushing into any decisions about her future.
I really just need to spend some time with my kids and just take a break, mentally and physically, just to regroup, fill my cup, and just be human and be normal for a little bit. What does the future hold? I don't know. I'm going to go back and just review, talk to my family, talk to my team, and see what we're going to do.
The swimming program is over, and as expected, the Americans and Australians dominated, with the US winning 11 of the 35 gold medals on offer, and Australia took home 9. American freestyle star Caleb Dressel finished with 5 gold medals, including a world record in his final event, the 100 medley relay. He follows in the wake of the likes of Michael Phelps and Mark Spitz as multiple gold medal winners at a single games.
My goal is not to beat Michael, my goal is not to beat Mark. I feel like I've already exceeded my expectations here. I'm happy with what I did. I know I can be better. It wasn't a perfect meet at all. I mean, there was, I think, a lot more low points at this meet and, you know, mental obstacles than there were those podium finishes.
Australian Emma McKeown became the first female swimmer to win 7 medals at a single games. She took home 4 gold and 3 bronze. Belarusian sprinter Kristina Timanovska voiced fears for her safety as she refused an order to fly home early from the Olympics for criticising her coaches. The 24-year-old says she sought police protection at the airport terminal so she would not have to board the flight. And reminiscent of a South Korean boxer's protest at the 88 Olympics, which involved New Zealand referee Keith Walker, French fighter Murad Aliyev staged a remarkable sit-in protest because he was angry at being disqualified. And local patience is being tested after organisers said they were investigating athletes drinking alcohol in a park at the Olympic Village the day after two Georgian silver medalists were told to leave the Games for taking a sightseeing trip in Tokyo, where COVID-19 cases are surging. Today, kayaker Lisa Carrington starts her quest for a third Olympic title. She's in 4 events this week, and while she's a medal contender in all 4, she says she's focused solely on performance and not results.
I don't know if basking in that light before it's happened is kind of something that I want to do or need to do or like to do. So I'm excited to get out there and perform. It's been a long 5 years, and just excited to just show the world what we've got.
Also defending a title today are the 49er sailors Peter Burling and Blair Tuke, who stormed back from a rough start to their regatta to go into today's double points medal race with a 4-point lead. Tuke says they're ready to finish strongly.
Well, it's certainly been a heck of a battle out there. We've had to fight for every point. It's nice to be leading going into the medal race, but it's very close behind, so it just shows the level of competition, and excited to have the opportunity to go and try win another gold medal for Aotearoa.
Weightlifter Laurel Hubbard will make history today when she becomes the first openly transgender athlete to compete at the Olympics. There has been a lot of talk ahead of her competition, with both the Weightlifting Federation and the IOC confirming her right to compete. New Zealand Olympic boss Karen Smith says the global debate must be incredibly difficult for Hubbard.
definitely think it can be dehumanising. I've certainly seen evidence of that in some of the comments that have been made. And, you know, people might have a view, but I think there's respectful ways that people can exercise their view. And in a day where we're talking about mental health a lot, I think we have to be mindful that, you know, this is, you know, Laurel Hubbard is a person and she has feelings and she is eligible to do what she's doing here on the Olympic stage, and we wish her all the very best.
Eventing medals are up for grabs today, with Tim Price in fourth place and the New Zealand team also in fourth place heading into the show jumping. And the track cycling program starts with New Zealand in the women's and men's team pursuit qualifying.
Barry Guy with that report and commentary courtesy of Sky Sport. Now to the medal table, China top it with 24 gold, the US have 20 and Japan 17. New Zealand is in 12th spot, which is pretty good, 4 gold, 3 silver and 4 bronze. Let's hope we can add a couple more golds to that today.
Well, back here, the popularity of the Labour government's taken a big hit in the latest political poll. The News Hub Reid Research poll has Labour down 9.7 points to 43%, National inching up 1.7 points to 28.7. ACT, though, scored its highest ever rating on this poll, up 4.2 points to just over 11%. Its leader, David Seymour, says Labour's loss is ACT and National's gain.
The real story of this poll is both ACT and National rising. I believe that's due to disillusionment with the government's performance on substantial issues, being housing, COVID recovery and law and order on the streets.
The National Party still sits a clear second place in the poll, and while the boost is less than half that of ACT's, leader Judith Collins is happy with the results. She says far from vote splitting, ACT's results are a good thing for National.
ACT coming up is ultimately good for National because we're also going up, so it's not as though it's taking votes off us. So that's good. And what I see is that that means that there is certainly, if we can both keep going in that direction, then that will be very good and give us a very good chance for the next election.
RNZ political editor Jane Patterson is with us. Jane, kia ora, good morning. It's a big drop for Labour here.
It is, and the government has a lot going on at the moment, a lot of balls in the air, and COVID and housing are two of those that they really have to keep an eye on. COVID, of course, you know, the government's been given kudos for the way it initially handled it, but, you know, real questions and maybe a lack of confidence in the vaccine rollout, and especially as Kiwis see this Delta outbreak in Sydney, so it becomes very real about the implications for New Zealand and the health system if Delta gets into New Zealand. And housing, it just continues to be a massive problem for the government and really resonating with voters. This is such a big issue for voters about both affordability and also rental. And that could come with problems down the line too. We've got interest rates creeping up, so if people are going to be paying more of their money on mortgages, people over leveraged, struggling to pay their mortgages, there's storm clouds on the horizon too. And then we just have a lot of social issues that I think are just causing problems. You know, people asking actually whose interests is the government governing for, and the mongrel mob payment I think is a really good example and is an issue that is going to really rile those centre ground voters.
National and Judith Collins, not being the kind of, are they capitalising, I suppose, on some of these problems that the government is facing in terms of these numbers?
Well, Judith Collins and National is not. She is not connecting with the voters. That party vote is staying stable, and that's about it, and that is their base core voters. They are not winning any voters out of this. Now, her and David Seymour are talking a good game about the centre-right. David Seymour, of course, has reason to talk a better game. He has got a big bump for his party. He and ACT have been pretty consistent. They've been very proactive on COVID, offering solutions. They do have that new caucus, though. They haven't really been released into the wild yet, so we haven't seen them in action. It's really been about David Seymour, but this is a problem for Judith Collins. She is not shifting the dial. They are both talking about the centre-right rising, but National needs to be getting those votes, not letting ACT mop them all up.
And when you look at centre-right block and centre-left block, there is
there's still some daylight in between those two.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, of course, look at the state of the election cycle that we're in. There is plenty of time to play, as all leaders will say. So the interesting thing about this is the numbers are starting to move around. Labour can no longer govern alone. So we're getting back into that territory where David Seymour said, you know, 10 seats between the centre-right and centre-left. But you know, Labour's still popular, they're still in a commanding position. And the other thing I'd say too, you know, we do look for trends in these polls. There are fewer political polls around at the moment, so we'll be looking for that trend line for Labour. Is this just a blip, or is this a serious inroads into their vote?
When you're talking about numbers moving around, who do you think it is that's moving around here? Is it national voters going to ACT? Is it, you know, where is it that these that this 9 point or almost 10 point drop has come for Labour?
Well, yeah, I think you have to draw the line between the loss of voters that National had at the election and the voters that Labour picked up. And they are voters obviously willing to look at different options, and that option appears to be ACT at the moment. So that may make sense that, you know, a person who had supported National, was completely disillusioned with them, went to Labour for the election, is now looking around for other options and see ACT as a more credible option at the moment.
Appreciate your time. Thank you. Jane Patterson, RNZ political editor.
The Human Rights Commission is this morning announcing a national inquiry into the housing crisis. It says successive governments have failed to give New Zealanders decent homes, and it says the housing crisis is also a human rights crisis. Chief Commissioner Paul Hunt joins us now. Morena.
Kia ora.
Okay, I think we can get the why you might be doing this. Everyone can see that there is a housing crisis in New Zealand, has been for some time, but I'm curious as to what you hope to achieve. What would be the best outcome from an inquiry?
Well, Corin, look, I want governments to keep their human rights promises which they made to the people of New Zealand. And amongst those human rights promises is the human right to a decent home. This is binding on the international law. Successive governments have been bound by this law for some 50 or more years. And it's not just a slogan, it's not just a bumper sticker. This human right has got substantive content, and that's why we've written these guidelines in partnership with the National Iwi Chairs Forum and supported by Community Housing Aotearoa and others.
I understand what you're saying, but what I'm curious as to what's actually going to change? Because if we look at what the government is building, the highest number of state houses I think any government's built for quite some time. Housing consents are at record levels. They have addressed the issues around speculation with the bright line test and the tax deductibility rules. It's not like they're sitting there. In fact, the last government was also trying its hardest. So what on top of that do you want to see?
The present government's housing package announced earlier this year is a good start. The Housing Acceleration Fund to $3.8 billion, the bright line test extended from 5 years to 10 years. These are good starts, but more can be done, Corin. Now, look, the government has just put out, or it put out a few weeks ago, its GPS, its government policy statement on housing and urban development. We've made a submission, the Human Rights Commission's made a submission to the government about that. It's a good direction of travel. There's lots of good content in it. It could be reinforced, strengthened and improved if there were explicit references to the human right to a decent home. And if I could just give you one example, right at the end of the document on page 77 or thereabouts, there are four sentences, four little paragraphs, saying there's going to be a monitoring framework. Look, HUD can't monitor HUD. This monitoring framework has to be one what the human rights people call constructive accountability, independent constructive accountability, making sure that government keeps its promises. And HUD can't monitor HUD. Government can't monitor government. So that's one of the contributions that is
okay, so you put pressure on, but I'm curious as to what you can do to get the private sector, for example, to invest more and build more houses. And is there not a danger that if you were to push for more intervention, some economists might argue that you might make matters worse by deterring people from investing? Say, if you were to crack down further on speculation.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point, Corin. But look, if you take a look at when you get a chance to take a look at the guidelines, we talk about it's restrictive housing regulations that can't be justified, that are culturally inappropriate. They need to be removed. you know, part of the right...
Can you just give me a couple of examples of those before we go? We're just about short of time, but just what are some of the examples of that?
Let me give you one doable. The Kayanga Ora and some council-controlled organisations, they presently impose housing caps on land that it sells. Now, that imposes significant restrictions on what new land owners are able to do with the land. And the guise is avoiding slums. But what those caps can lead to is gentrification and reduced housing choices. So, look, that the caps have, in principle, they're okay. But they must be evidence-based, and they mustn't have a disproportionate impact on disadvantaged groups. It's that sort of analysis that the human right to a decent home, grounded on Te Tiriti, can bring.
Paul Hunt, thank you very much for that. Chief Commissioner there from the Human Rights Commission.
Hui anō, a three-day mass vaccination event in Manukau, Auckland, hit its target at the weekend with more than 15,500 people given their first dose of the Mate Corona vaccine. Most of those who went to get their injection at the event say they had a positive experience.
It's been very efficient and everyone's very nice and it's, yeah, totally impressed.
I was a little daunting going inside. There was quite a bit of people there, but afterwards it was really nice, like the St. John's people and everyone in there was just really nice and helpful.
Yeah, I feel the process is a well organised, it's a good one.
Process was very smooth, no problem. I didn't have to wait long. Everybody knew what they were doing. Yes, very good, no problems.
With us now, Alex Pym, who led the programme. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
It seemed there was a bit of a slow start on this one, but how do you feel it turned out?
Oh, I think it's been an absolute fantastic success. We've vaccinated over 15,500 people, and I think that's just a brilliant achievement for a three-day event.
What would you like to do better?
I think there's always things that we can do to improve. So for our next event in 6 weeks' time, we want to make the experience even better for people coming through. We made some changes as we went through the event, including putting on some additional staff to speed up that registration process at the MIT campus, as well as little tweaks during the day just to make every part of the process slightly quicker and have a slightly better experience for people coming through.
How confident are you that the 15,000 people that were given their first dose will be back for the second shot?
So I would just encourage everybody, whether they've received their first dose through this event or through other vaccination centres in the city, to make sure that they turn up for their second appointment. And if it's not convenient to them, then there's lots of opportunity for them to reschedule into other vaccination centres across the city.
And as for further options, do you think these mass vaccination events could well be one of the best ways to catch people?
Well, I think mass vaccination has a part to play alongside all the other ways that people can receive their vaccine. We've got community vaccination centres, we've got a growing number of GP practices and pharmacies in the city. So I think it's about giving people choice and options that best suits them. I think what we've seen and what we've demonstrated this weekend is that mass vaccination is a model that works for New Zealand, and I look forward to future announcements about more events.
Ngā mihi, thank you very much. Alex Pym, who led that three-day mass vaccination programme.
Pacifica communities in New Zealand are relieved the dark days of the 1970s dawn raids are at last being formally acknowledged. Pacifica families flocked to Aotearoa to fill a labour shortage until an economic downturn pitted them as the scapegoat. They were deported and forced out of what they had come to know as home. Nearly 50 years on, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern yesterday delivered an unreserved sorry to those who were left traumatised for life. Mauruna Whāgai Awa Mula from RNZ Pacific was there.
Auckland Town Hall filled to the brim for a day that will go down in the history of Aotearoa New Zealand. Thousands congregating in silence at the moment the Prime Minister apologises for a racist immigration policy that tore apart a proud people. Labour MP Anahi Lakanongata Suisuiki cries loudly in despair as our Ie Tsonga, or fine mat, is draped onto Ms. Ardern. The Ie Tsonga covering her, contemporary practice of Ifonga, a traditional Samoan display of reconciliation, reserved for those who've perpetrated serious crimes. Then, elders of the Pasifika community removed the Ie Tsonga from Ms. Ardern's head as a symbol of forgiveness.
The government expresses its sorrow, remorse and regret that the Dawn raids and random police checks occurred and that these actions were ever considered appropriate. Our government conveys to the future generations of Aotearoa that the past actions of the Crown were wrong and that the treatment of your ancestors was wrong.
A range of speakers then reflected on their Dawn raids experiences, including Tsoe Sulu Brown. She was recognised by the New Zealand Order of Merit as a pioneer of Ngangana Samoa being taught in the country's classrooms. She says those who couldn't speak fluent English were immediate targets of police.
We lived in Ponsonby, and for what I can remember, it was none of my kids ever were stopped. I guess because they could say, you know, vocalise and speak English. And me and my husband were never stopped. And yet we were sort of brown.
She says whilst the Dawn raids represent dark clouds in Pasifika history, it's time to move on.
I hope that all the people who were actually, you know, went through that pain, their families would accept it. Because we have chosen New Zealand as our home.
More than 7,000 people signed a petition asking for an apology and for the Dawn raids to be part of the school curriculum. And last night it was announced that resources will indeed be provided to teach about the raids in schools in Kura. $2.1 million will be put into academic and vocational scholarships for Pasifika communities here. $1 million will go to training courses for delegates from Samoa, Tonga, Tuvalu and Fiji. Benji Timu, who organised the petition with Josiah Tuala-Mali'i, is delighted.
Yeah, definitely the Victory for People Power, but also, you know, it's not just about Josiah and I making this petition, it's actually about all the people coming together and you know, come here to be seen, pretty much.
Benji Timu says he respects the government for fulfilling his petition's wishes.
It's actually so much easier than it looks. So, you know, with all the sort of bureaucracies and all the politics and stuff, you know, put that to the side and really just go straight on.
He stops to shed a tear for those who couldn't see the fruits of their labour.
Yeah, I'm emotional now, just trying to hold it in. Bawling my eyes out, honestly, just in the crowd. Just thinking about like people in the past, you know, those who aren't here with us anymore, and I guess for those people who saw this as a normal thing.
In a gift-giving ceremony known as the Sua, larger fine mats were given to the attending Tongan princess Melesio Ilikutapu Kalanyo Valufoto Fili. Rugby legend La Auli Sir Michael Jones was very moved by the apology.
I think the symbolism of the Prime Minister here under the Ie Tonga and that Ifonga process and the lifting of that and the hugging and I thought that was the moment there to me.
E whawhanga whānau a manu whelelei i funga la au, a e whawhanga whānau a tangata i upu matala. The birds feed their young ones with tree blossoms and flowers, but parents feed their children with words and stories handed down from generation to generation through our oral histories. And indeed, it is a history entrenched forever as the government finally said sorry for the Dawn raids.
Well, Dame Valerie Adams hopes her fourth Olympic medal will inspire her children, her sister and women around the world. Already with two Olympic gold medals and a silver to her name, the 36-year-old New Zealand shot putter completed the set with bronze at her fifth Games in Tokyo yesterday. It makes Dame Valerie just the third woman in Olympic history to win four medals in one event. The success comes after Dame Valerie took time away from athletics to have two children after the 2016 Games in Rio. Well, Clay Wilson reports from Tokyo on why soaking in the most meaningful moment of her career is taking priority over any decisions about what the future holds.
2 Olympic gold medals, a silver and 10 world championship titles. But for Dame Valerie Adams, Olympic bronze at her 5th Games as a mother of 2 at the age of 36 tops the lot. She says her success in Tokyo is not only for herself and New Zealand, but for her kids and others all around the world.
My biggest inspiration was drawn from my children, and being able to take a medal home not only for New Zealand but to do it as a mum. I just really hope to inspire any athletes out there that if they want to become a mum, they can do it and come back and still be at the top of their event.
Successfully doing just that was one of the reasons for the emotion Adams displayed once her bronze medal was safe. She says it was a feeling of pure happiness, as her screams of elation echoed around an empty Tokyo Olympic stadium.
Just a release of like, we did it, and just how extremely emotional I was at that moment. But also just this quick reflection of what had happened the last 5 years, what it's taken to be here, travels up and down the country, being away from my children to make this happen. That just all surfaced at that very moment of knowing that you've secured a medal.
That doesn't mean her job in Japan is done. Adams won't be home for another 2 months, as she stays on to coach younger sister Lisa in the shot put at her first Paralympic Games. While it means longer before she can reunite with her husband and kids, it's a sacrifice she's happy to make.
Obviously a very proud moment for not only myself as her big sister, but also for our family. We are well represented around the world, so it's going to be an amazing time. So I just hope to continue to take that positive feeling and continue to be her hype girl.
After that will come a well-earned rest. And although this moment may seem the perfect way to close out an immensely successful career, Dame Valerie says she won't be rushing into any decisions.
I really just need to spend some time with my kids and just take a break, mentally and physically, just to regroup, fill my cup, and just be human and be normal for a little bit. What does the future hold? I don't know. I'm going to go back and just review, talk to my family, talk to my team, and see what we're going to do.
Victoria's Black Ferns Sevens are due back home this morning. With gold medals in hand, the team beat France in the final to win 26-12 at the Tokyo Olympics. But it's not just their stunning game that's won plaudits, it's also some of their media interviews. Absolutely fantastic, you've got to say. Here's player Ruby Tui talking to the BBC after the quarterfinal against the Russian Olympic Committee.
Yeah, the Russia, they are very cool people, man. We get on with them, very lovely people. But on the field, as I said before, they are bloody tough. They're a tough, tough team. And to be honest, they weren't at the last Olympics, so this is huge for them. Massive congratulations to Russia. Thank you so much. But I don't want to say the score made it look easy, but it was not easy. Don't be fooled. That was not an easy game. Lots of running. My GPS just blew up. That's how hard it was. So, lots of respect for Russia.
Listen, thank you so much, Ruby. I've been told you have to go because I think the rain's coming. We'll see you tomorrow.
What rain? Bring on the thunder. We're at the Olympics. Let's be happy. Let's compete safely and peacefully. Peace and love. Love you, guys.
Some absolute gold there from Ruby Tui. Now, I spoke earlier to Captain Sarah Hirani, who said the team is certainly full of personality.
We've got so many characters in our team, and for them to be able to just be themselves, be genuine when they're doing interviews, it's really nice. Like and the amount of exposure that these girls are getting because they are being themselves it's been quite funny for us, really. But we know what they're really like, and I'm just glad the rest of the world gets to see them as well.
And the game of sevens, I think I heard in one of the interviews about some of the struggles other teams have had to get there, but this has really cemented it. So do you think that the game of sevens and as a career option now for young women is something really exciting?
It's 100% a career option. We've been a professional program since 2014. We're centralised in the mountain. It's a pathway, it's a opportunity to go to the Olympics. You get to go to Commonwealth Games, World Cups, World Series, you travel the world, and you can make a living from it now. And for me, it's just such a great opportunity, and I hope that we've at least inspired a few young girls, even boys, who want to pick up the game of sevens, because it's just such an amazing game to play.
Well, it's a reminder, isn't it, that the games were played in great spirit. You could see that through the television, that the respect for the other teams, the other players. But, boy, some big hits. It's pretty tough stuff, isn't it?
That's what I love about sevens. You have to be fast and you have to be fit. But the physical side of the game probably goes a little bit unnoticed. And there's some pretty big hits out there. And when athletes are flying into each other, it's a pretty awesome way to play the game. And yeah, it's all right. I'll happily take what I've got on my eye if I'm taking this gold medal home.
Sarah, for you as captain, it must be especially rewarding. And you talked to afterwards about the recent loss of your mother. This must be a pretty special reflective period for you.
Yeah, it's just for me, pretty special to be able to give something nice back to my family after, it has been a hard few months, and I'm sure it will continue for a long time yet. Just the pain that we've felt lately, and to be able to give them, something nice to celebrate has been really awesome. And being able to talk to them through FaceTime and just showing them a gold medal, it was really, really nice to see my dad with a big smile on his face last night. So I can't wait to get home and share it with them in person. And I know my family are really looking forward to having me home as well.
Kia ora, that sounds fantastic. And the journey home, I suppose that you have to do the MIQ, do you, as well, so everyone's in the same boat?
Yep, we're all on a chartered flight back to Christchurch tonight, and we're doing MIQ individually for a couple of weeks, and then hopefully, get out all going well and in the middle of August.
I'm sure there'll be plenty of people around the country wanting to see the gold medals. Did you have a chance to see some of the other teams after the win, the men's side or anybody else, to sort of share in the celebrations?
We haven't actually seen them yet. They're in a hotel around the corner, so we'll see them at the airport on our flight home. But I've seen a few of the rowers, Emma Twigg and people like that. So, being able to share that success with them is amazing, and it's going to be a pretty awesome plane ride home.
And that was Black Ferns Sevens captain Sarah Hiddeny with a fantastic effort from the team.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.